In the normal course of events, a speculative price rise provokes countervailing forces. Supply is increased and demand reduced, and the temporary excess is corrected with the passage of time. But there are exceptions. In foreign exchange, for example, a sustained price movement can be self-validating because of its impact on domestic price levels. The same is true in the stock market, where the performance of a stock may affect the performance of the company in question in a number of ways. And in examining the recent history of international lending, we shall find that excessive lending first increased the borrowing capacity of debtor countries, as measured by their debt ratios, and then, when the banks wanted to be repaid, the debtor country's ability to do so evaporated. Generally speaking, we shall find that the expansion and contraction of credit can affect the debtor's ability and willingness to pay. Are these exceptions that confirm the rule, or do they necessitate a revision of accepted theory? The answer depends on the frequency and severity of their occurrence. If we are dealing with an isolated instance, we can treat it as a paradox. But if one incident follows another, we must question the theory. I contend that such paradoxical behavior is typical of all financial markets that serve as a discounting mechanism for future developments, notably stock markets, foreign exchange markets, banking, and all forms of credit. Microeconomic theory may continue to ignore it because there are large areas of economic activity where it occurs only occasionally or not at all. But we cannot expect to understand macroeconomic developments without taking the phenomenon into account. A world of fluctuating exchange rates and large-scale capital movements is characterized by vicious and benign circles in which the normal pattern of causation, as defined by classical economics, seems to be reversed. Market developments dictate the evolution of the conditions of supply and demand, not the other way around. If the process of adjustment does not lead to an equilibrium, what happens to the conclusions of economic theory? The answer is that they remain valid as deductions, but they lose their relevance to the real world. If we want to understand the real world, we must divert our gaze from a hypothetical final outcome and concentrate our attention on the process of change that we can observe all around us. This will require a radical shift in our thinking. A process of change is much more difficult to understand than a static equilibrium. We shall have to revise many of our preconceived ideas about the kind of understanding that is attainable, and satisfy ourselves with conclusions that are far less definite than those that economic theory sought to provide. The understanding of the actual course of events, as distinct from a hypothetical equilibrium, poses problems that have not been properly appreciated. The problems arise because participants base their decisions on an inherently imperfect understanding of the situation in which they participate. My approach is to tackle the problem of imperfect understanding head-on. What makes the participants' understanding imperfect is that their thinking affects the situation to which it relates. The causal role played by the participants' thinking has no counterpart in the phenomena studied by natural scientists. It is obviously not the only force shaping the course of events, but it is a force which is unique to events that have thinking participants. Hence, it deserves to take center stage. As we have seen, imperfect understanding is a very difficult concept to work with. We have established that there is a lack of correspondence between the participant's thinking and the situation to which it relates. But the lack of correspondence is difficult to define, let alone measure. The participant's thinking is part of the situation to which it relates, and the very idea of correspondence is inappropriate to describing a relationship between a part and a whole. The idea was imported from natural science, where facts and statements belong to separate universes, and from philosophy, where correspondence serves as the criterion of truth. The analogy does not apply to the participant, who is, by definition, part of the situation that he is trying to understand. We can speak of a lack of correspondence, but we cannot define that to which the participant's understanding fails to correspond because it simply does not exist. To simplify matters, I shall speak of an inherent bias in the participant's thinking. Since the bias is inherent, the unbiased is unattainable. There is, however, a norm in the outside world against which the participant's bias can be measured. Although there is no reality independent of the participant's perception, there is a reality that is dependent on it. In other words, there is a sequence of events that actually occurs, and that sequence reflects the participant's behavior. The actual course of events is likely to differ from the participant's expectations, and the divergence can be taken as an indication of the participant's bias. Unfortunately, it can be taken only as an indication, not as the full measure of the bias, because the actual course of events already incorporates the effects of the participant's thinking. Thus, the participant's bias finds expression both in the divergence between outcome and expectations and in the actual course of events. A phenomenon that is partially observable and partially submerged in the course of events does not lend itself readily to scientific investigation. We can now appreciate why economists were so anxious to eliminate it from their theories. We shall make it the focal point of our investigation. The connection between the participant's thinking and the situation in which they participate can be broken up into two functional relationships. I call the participant's efforts to understand the situation the cognitive or passive function, and the impact of their thinking on the real world, the participating or active function. In the cognitive function, the participant's perceptions depend on the situation. In the participating function, the situation is influenced by the participant's perceptions. It can be seen that the two functions work in opposite directions. In the cognitive function, the independent variable is the situation. In the participating function, it is the participant's thinking. There are many cases where one or the other function can be observed in isolation, but there are also instances where they are both operating at the same time. An obvious example of the cognitive function is when someone learns from experience. Examples of the participating function are to be found in textbooks of economics, where the participants apply a given set of preferences to a given set of opportunities and in the process determine prices. When both functions operate at the same time, they interfere with each other. Functions need an independent variable in order to produce a determinate result, but in this case, the independent variable of one function is the dependent variable of the other. Instead of a determinate result, we have an interplay in which both the situations and the participants' views are dependent variables, so that an initial change precipitates further changes both in the situation and in the participants' views. I call this interaction reflexivity, using the word as the French do when they describe a verb whose subject and object are the same. This is the theoretical foundation of my approach. The two recursive functions do not produce an equilibrium, but a never-ending process of change. When a situation has thinking participants, the sequence of events does not lead directly from one set of facts to the next. Rather, it connects facts to perceptions and perceptions to facts in a shoelace pattern. Thus, the concept of reflexivity yields a shoelace theory of history. Returning to economic theory, it can be argued that it is the participant's bias that renders the equilibrium position unattainable. The target toward which the adjustment process leads incorporates a bias, and the bias may shift in the process. When that happens, the process aims not at an equilibrium, but at a moving target. How significant is the distortion introduced by neglecting the participant's bias? In microeconomic analysis, the distortion is negligible and the participant's bias can be accounted for easily. As a first step, the participant's bias can be taken as given. That provides a static equilibrium. To make the analysis more dynamic, changes in the participant's bias can be added piecemeal, expressed as changes in consumer habits or production methods. All that is obscured by this piecemeal approach is the possible connection between the various changes in the conditions of supply and demand. But that omission does not invalidate the conclusions microeconomic analysis seeks to establish. When it comes to financial markets, the distortion is more serious. The participant's bias is an element in determining prices, and no important market development leaves the participant's bias unaffected. The search for an equilibrium price turns out to be a wild goose chase, and theories about the equilibrium price can themselves become a fertile source of bias. To paraphrase J.P. Morgan, financial markets will continue to fluctuate. In trying to deal with macroeconomic developments, equilibrium analysis is totally inappropriate. Nothing could be further removed from reality than the assumption that participants base their decisions on perfect knowledge. People are groping to anticipate the future with the help of whatever guideposts they can establish. The outcome tends to diverge from expectations, leading to constantly changing expectations and constantly changing outcomes. The process is reflexive. In his General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, Keynes managed to show that full employment is a special case. If we could develop a general theory of reflexivity, equilibrium would appear as a special case. While it will hardly qualify as a general theory, I shall try to explore the role of reflexivity in financial markets. That means that I shall try to interpret their functioning as a historical process.